Today is July 19th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. And in New York City, today is one hot, humid day. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King, and he's on remote. Boy, he's in a cool spot. We are heard each Wednesday. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 o'clock Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, and the program is live stream on the Internet at WBAI.org at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. You know, last week we had a special on the convergence of health with technology, and many people have said they missed it, and I said there's a podcast. Well, podcasts of that program and other programs are available on PRN.FM, WBAI.org, and our website, PCRadioShow.org. When WBAI is in membership drive, a replacement program may be scheduled, but the regular programming will continue to be on PRN.FM. Tonight, WBAI is in a membership drive, but we will be on at 9 o'clock Eastern Time with a different program. How you doing, Joe?
I'm doing terrific, Hank. I couldn't be better.
Yeah, of course. You don't have to go through the heat.
How do you like the way I lie? It sounds real good.
Yeah, I know. Listen, you got your foot on the ottoman, and you got a tequila in the left hand, and you got a, I don't know what you got in your right hand. Probably the phone.
In my right hand, I have the tablet from which I'm reading what we're going to be doing tonight.
Well, let's get to it. And there was quite a number of things that were that happened the last week. Verizon, let's talk about Verizon, okay? It turned out that last week or late in June, Verizon had 6 million customer records that were accidentally released by a vendor, one of their vendors. It's called Nice Systems. It's a Verizon vendor located in Israel. And it was quickly discovered by UpGuard, a privately owned company that goes through and looks for breaches. And they informed Verizon immediately, and they went through it. And it turns out that other than UpGuard and Nice, no one else had access it. So that's the good news. But there was an awful lot of information on there.
Hank, what Verizon has a lot of business. They have the Internet business. They have the wireless business. They have the telephone and data businesses. Which one got broken into?
They didn't say, but 6 million customers does not sound like it sounds like a more of a
wireless.
Wireless? I think they got more than 6 million wireless customers. That's why. I mean, 6 million is a low, very low number.
Actually, I think they got 6 million of any of the subcategories, so maybe it was just a part of something that went loose.
Well, the thing is that what happened was that, it was a human error. It's not a system error, but you could say it's a system error where when data is uploaded or data is downloaded, whichever you want to describe it, you know, as part of the change management, they must have a better procedure other than one person saying, oh, put this up, and then, you know, there's no one to follow up, no one to check on it. There's got to be some extra procedure put in, but it was really...
I was just laughing to myself, Hank, because you just described so many small business procedures that I've been involved with.
Well, you know, the things that I talk about is things that I did, since 1960, and these procedures don't change. And you say to yourself, don't people learn from these?
The answer is the people that it happens to learn from it. The people who read about it say, oh, that could never happen to me.
Oh, you mean it's one of those things where, yeah, I know it, you know, yeah, it happens. But just like you, Joe, it's like you would say, I don't back up because nothing will happen to me.
That's not true. No, you're lying. You're telling a lie. You're telling a fib. I bought myself a Western Digital 1 terabyte USB drive, and I got hold of a program you may have heard of. What was the name of that one, Hank?
Acronis.
Acronis.
Yes.
And Acronis tells me how to do it, when to do it, why to do it. And they do it. I don't have to worry about it anymore. I was looking at that Western Digital drive this morning, and 10% of that drive is already full with backups.
You know, you could probably clean it up a little. You know that.
Oh, I could, but I'm experimenting.
Yeah. Well, you know, since we're talking about Verizon, this is something that I want to report on because it's something I researched. You're not going to find this on the Internet because no one's really looked at it other than me in a more serious way. I happen to have gotten Fios service about 3 years ago, and I'm happy with it. I have to tell you, compared to the Time Warner service, which is now called Spectrum, it's faster. I don't have any frozen frames. But something happened last year. In other words, after 2 years of having it, I go downstairs to the basement where I have the laundry room. I hear this beep, 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 beep sound, you know, and I says, what the heck is that? And, you know, when you have a high-pitched beeping sound, it's non-directional. You have no idea where it's coming from.
It's worse than that, Hank, because people like me can't hear it. The same thing happened to me, but it went for 2 weeks before I saw the flashing red light.
Oh, okay. Well, what happened was that it turns out it was the Verizon box, and the box is called an optical network terminal. And I said, oh, okay. I see a flashing light. I contacted Verizon. I says, I see this flashing light. What does it mean? They said, well, it means that the battery's got to be changed. Oh, what's the battery? It's a backup battery. Oh, okay. So my wife said to me, listen, let's not fool around. We'll pay them. We'll get it done. So I said, what's the cost to change the battery? Is it still under warranty? Oh, no, battery's not part of the service. You know, when a battery replacement, you have to pay for it yourself. And I said, okay. And they instructed me how to remove the battery, which I did because it was not a small battery. It was a big 12-volt wet cell battery. That is not something to play.
It's not like the car battery, but it was heavy. I did the same thing, Hank, but go ahead and finish your story because it's fascinating.
Yeah, because I said, gee, the battery is dead. I got to replace it. And I said, but the TV works. The Internet works. The phone works. So what's the battery for? And when I spoke to them, they said, well, it's for backup. Okay, it's for backup. What's it cost to have your guy come in to change the battery? About $100. I said, what? $100? What if I want to do it myself? Okay, you can buy the battery from us. And I said, okay, I'll buy the battery from them. I don't want to play around with clone batteries. I've had enough heartaches with clone batteries, all right? And I said, how much is it? They said, that's $40. Okay, $40. Oh, what? Plus tax. Okay. No, just sales tax. I understand. Plus shipping. It came out to $50.
Did they tell you you should expect that $50 about every 2.5 to 3 years?
How about 2 years? It was 2 years.
It was 2 years?
Yeah. Now,
when I did it, they told me it should last anything from 2.5 to 3 years.
Well, all batteries will vary. So I said, okay, I did it. And so the battery came in, and I looked it up on YouTube, the how do you take out the battery and so on. And I said, you know what? Let me find out how much this battery would cost if I went on Amazon to find out if I bought a non-Verizon product. Gee, the battery was $21. I said, okay, next time I'll be smarter, you know, $21, $22. And so I said, okay, I put it in. And then I'm sitting there saying, what is the battery used for? So I went onto the Verizon site, and I did some research on it. Now, when you install Fios, you get what is called an optical network terminal. The fiber optic cable comes in from the outside. It goes into this little box, okay? Actually, it's not a little box. It's a pretty big box. And it's called optical network terminal. And the purpose is that it converts the signal coming in from the fiber optic line into copper. And it converts it into three copper lines. And the copper line, of course, is one is for, guess what, TV. One is for Internet, and the other one is for telephone. So, okay, I see that. Oh, so I said to myself, gee, I wonder how much of a backup you have for that. Then I did some more research on the Verizon website. It does not back up the TV. In other words, if you lose power, the battery will not give you TV. Oh, okay. If you lose the...
No. That's confusing. If you lose power and the battery, it will not affect your TV.
No. I'm saying if you lose AC power, If you lose AC power, in other words, Con Ed, had a blackout. Okay.
Blackout would still block you out.
Yeah. In other words, it does not give you, the battery does not back up the TV at all. All right.
That's correct.
It does not back up the internet at all. Okay.
That is also correct.
And it backs up only the telephone if you have the telephone service, which is a VoIP service, all right? And I said, oh, okay. And then wait a minute. I have a base telephone unit that requires AC. So without the AC, this is no good. This is just only for the service.
That's right.
So what do I need the battery for?
You don't.
You don't. So in other words, it's like, number one, it's a wet cell battery. In other words, it's not something you can, go down to Staples or, pick up. I mean, a wet cell is not a regular consumer item. And it turns out that I said to myself, you know what? If I had a UPS unit, a low-cost UPS unit, and I stick it in and use that, so that's backup power, that replaces the battery. Okay, so I looked it up. And on Amazon? No, it's Walmart, okay? They have a cyber power UPS unit for $21, $22. I could have done that. So next time it goes out, I'll put in a low-cost UPS unit, and I'll be done with it. But I say to myself, what in the – I got to be careful with my language, all right? What possessed the engineers to come up with a 12-volt battery design in their architecture?
Well, that was their problem. I went through a similar story with my Fios out on the island, Hank, except that I went and found out about it through the back door. We did not need landline telephones out there, so I decided to call Verizon and tell them I did not need them. And they said to me, well, don't you have ADT in that house, burglar alarms? And I said, yes, we do. He said, well, it's going through the, right now, it's going through your telephone lines.
Oh.
I called up ADT. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, for $7 and something a month, $7.35 a month or something like that, they would give me a wireless ADT. They wouldn't use the Verizon system. I looked at how much I was spending on the phone, around $20 a month. I deducted the $7. I said, hey, I could save some real money. So we did that. And then one day I was getting some very bad service. The ADT was flickering. So I called them up, and they said, has nothing to do with us. I said, well, they said, no, it's got something to do with Verizon. We're using their wireless signal. Called back Verizon. They would send a person out to the house for a $100 service call unless they found out it was their fault.
Right.
Then they wouldn't charge me.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I had no choice. I said, come on out. We made an appointment when I could be there easily. They came out. They went into the basement. I said that the junction box is out on the back porch. And they said, yeah, but there's something in the basement you don't even know about. I went down with them, and there was this
battery
flashing red. And I said, what's that got to do with anything that we're doing? I still have TV, I still have internet, and I still have a wireless signal for the phone. He said, yeah, but there's something cross-wired in here. We know about it. We're just not manufacturing differently right now. He took out the battery, called ADT. They tested the line. They said it was fine. He took the battery and went home.
Well, actually, I have a request for listeners who have file service, and I have two questions for them, and I would like to get some feedback. And if they send the information to either Hank or Joe at pcradioshow.org, and the question is simple. If you had three-way service, in other words, three-way meaning TV, internet, and the phone, and you decide to cut the cord on the landline, which it's not really a landline, it's a VoIP, it's a virtual line, and you're using your cell phone, do they take the battery out? And if they didn't take the battery out, and there's a problem with the battery, and you're not using the phone, do they still say, you got to replace the battery? I would like to know that. And the other question I have is, if you have only the two-way service without the phone, do they still put the battery in? Because to me, it's a marketing scam if they did.
Well, I did not have to replace the battery. As I said, they took it away. The battery was flashing red, so it was dead.
And it works fine without the battery.
Well, but I didn't have the landline. I had the double TV and internet, and then I had a special, I don't even know what the number was, so I couldn't use it, a special wireless number for ADT.
Oh, boy. Well, that's the...
Hank, it's human nature. Once you find a new way of doing something, somebody else will find a new way of fouling up what you're doing.
Yeah, but a 12-volt wet cell battery, I mean, that's insane. It really
was it
is.
Really a, was it really a wet cell? It was
yeah.
very heavy.
Yeah, it was weight, very... It no, it is wet cell. Trust me, it's a wet cell. 12-volt wet cell. And it looked like a smaller battery than a car battery that they use in a golf cart.
It was less than one-third the size of what my car battery was.
Yeah,
was
it's smaller than
like
your car battery.
Cell. It was like one cell out of the car battery.
Hey, you know, something else happened last week, and I'm laughing. You remember about, maybe a month or two ago, we were talking about the FAA requirements on drones, and they require that all drones, including recreation drones, including, you know, I mean, anything more than 6 ounces or 8 ounces, you have to register, and you have to file a form and pay $5 for the registration. In other words, a little toy you have to.
I thought that was a great idea. I do a little bit of flying in commercial airlines, and I did not really want to be brought down by a drone flying into its air and vent.
Oh, come on.
Hank.
Yeah, well, let me put this way.
If a bird goes flying into the air intake vent, it has brought down planes. Like, remember Chessie out in the... Hudson, because he's a hero.
Yeah,
that's how his plane went down.
Well, let me just say that someone took it to court, and the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia Circuit vacated the FAA registration rule, saying no, people don't have to register, they don't have to pay the $5. So the FAA,
stop. I went and got that rule to find out why. Was it something bad that was being done? Was it something that was being done?
It was a modernization. It's called the FAA Modernization and Reform Act signed by President Obama in 2012.
And the court decided that the law, which had been passed by, guess who? Congress.
Right.
Did not include that fee. So therefore, although it was a danger to commercial aviation, and although thousands of people could be killed, the court decided, hey, if it's a good thing, then let Congress pass it, but the FAA can't do it on their own.
Yeah, but can I tell you what I thought was...
How do I hate people who are against the government? How much do I hate them?
Oh, come on, Joe. Listen, you know, so you don't have to register, so the FAA says we'll refund the $5, but you have to go to Section 336. There's a form there. You got to fill it out, send it in. How many people are going to go through all that rigmarole to get a refund of $5?
Do you want my answer to that, really?
Yeah.
People who are so stupid that they don't want government regulations.
You know what? It's just like I've seen companies send out a bill for 5 cents, and it'll cost you more in a stamp just to put, just to send it back, you know?
Hank, I just got a check for $2.26 overcharged from Amazon.
Well, you tell them hang on to it, and that's my credit, right?
It seems to me that they would normally credit. I've gotten other credits from Amazon, but this one came in the mail.
Oh, hey, you know, one of the things that I'm always that you and I are very cautious about is storage. And whenever someone provides free storage, you got to be on the alert. Photo Bucket is a service.
Oh,
yeah,
that's a neat nightmare.
Yeah, well, it's a service that's 13, 14 years old, so it's not a fly-by-night thing. It was a service that started in 2003. And what they said is they're going to host all the pictures that you want to send it, and people can link into it. And in other words, they'll act as your host on all the photographs you have, and people were cross-linking to it, and they had something like 10 billion photos uploaded to it since 2003. That's a lot of photos. And many of the servers were cross-linking to it. Last week, they made an announcement.
Wait, before you go to the announcement, Hank.
Yeah.
They said they've amassed over 10 billion photos.
10 billion.
That's what I said, 10 billion.
From 100 million users.
Now, think of how many photos each user had to upload to get to that 10 billion. It's not possible.
Oh, it is. It is, because I know I take a lot of pictures, but I don't upload it. To me, I am always weird.
Hank, if you were one of 100 million users, you would have had to upload over a million pictures.
Did you remember Kodak Photo Gallery?
I do, but this is different.
Yeah,
it's giving you numbers.
Well, it's different.
A million times 100 million will give you 10 billion.
Yeah, well.
Or is it?
No, I think the decimal point goes the other way.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Then I apologize.
But the thing is, I remember with the Kodak Photo Gallery, it's like, gee, I mean, big company. They were part of the Dow Jones 30 and so on. And all of a sudden, they said, we're stopping, and you got a week to take all your stuff off. And that's one thing. But with PhotoBucket, it goes beyond that, because what they're saying is that you can upload all your photos and have other people cross-link and download those. In other words, you can cross-link it so that people can use your pictures to be downloaded, whereas with the Kodak Photo Gallery, it's just your stuff. So it's different.
Right.
Now let's get to what they said. They said we have to charge for a modest amount because this is getting out of hand. It's really an awful lot. And what was that modest amount they wanted?
Well, it turns out that amount is not so immodest, Hank, and I'll tell you why later in the evening.
But well, how about doing it now?
They're asking $400
a year.
Which is what, 30-something dollars a month. Now, the problem is that everybody's presenting it is that, as a matter of fact, the article I'm reading said a whopping $400 a year, not just $400.
Oh, they use the word whopping, okay?
Now, it's true that they did it stupidly from a PR point of view. All these 100 million users did not get any advance notification.
That's
true. With Kodak, they got 30 days notice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that they sent any notification. Possibly they put something online that day. But most people found out about it when they were linking to those pictures, as they were told they were allowed to, and suddenly the links were broken.
And with a broken link, it really is. Go ahead, Joe.
They point out one particular site that was a company called Petapixel,
mm-hmm.
and the site was still up there, but there were no pictures throughout it.
Yep.
That's pretty bad news from a person who's trying to either run a business or even a family venture. It just to not give anybody 10, 12 days notice is bad. 30 days notice is better. No notice? I don't buy that.
Well, let me just say that, you know, this is after 13, 14 years of collecting all those photos, that they're not evil people. It's just that they didn't manage it properly. I mean, there's a difference there.
Well, to you, they just didn't manage it properly. To me, they're evil people.
Oh, okay. Hey, you know, there was a company that you had tremendous interest in, and they just announced they're going to go out of business, Jawbone.
I still have two Jawbone.
And what they said was that the competition from Fitbit and Apple and all these wearables, it impacted them, and once it was a $3 billion company, and now they're closing their doors. It's unbelievable.
Well, it's also illogical to me.
Illogical?
Let me tell you why.
Okay.
They became a successful company primarily with Jawbone headsets, Bluetooth headsets. They put them in one ear, and you could speak through the mic and you could hear whatever it was you were talking with. I used them particularly with programs like Dragon Speaking, which needed a good, clear voice image. Now suddenly along comes all these companies like Fitbit and some of the others, but they weren't giving you just earphones. They were giving you wristwatches and heart murmurs and this and that and the other thing. And Jawbone did not have any of that, so they couldn't compete. Now, Jabra was a company that started also with headsets, but they did it mostly for telephone systems. And then when computers came out, they adapted and did a few for computers. And then when Fitbit came out, they adapted and did some of the Fitbit-type stuff. And they're still in business, Hank. There was no difference.
So what you're saying is with Jawbone is like they didn't look what was behind them, and they just rested on their initial laurels.
Exactly. I'm reminded of a story that was told by Henry Ford about his A. Ford Company car, which was available in any color the consumer wanted as long as it was black.
Well, you remember Satchel Paige?
Yeah, he used to say, be careful, don't look behind you, something may be catching up.
No, he said, someone's behind you and they're going to catch up with you.
Right. But here, what Jawbone was doing was what Henry Ford's favorite stories was. Jawbone was still making one of the very, very best buggy whips in the business. Hey, there aren't too many buggies out there that use whips.
Well,
I was down in Pennsylvania visiting some relatives, and I saw a lot of these Amish buggies, one-horse buggies, but none of them used whips. They just used their reins. They snapped them, and they whistled and did things. Jawbone was still selling a buggy whip. Granted, it was one of the best buggy whips I've ever used.
It was well-made, by the way.
That's why I liked it, and it even looked good. It had design on it.
Well, I know that last week with that special that we had, Dr. Alfred Poor talked about, you know, wearable technology is that it's changing so rapidly that will people spend that kind of money to constantly change every 6 months to a year? I mean,
no, but they will do something else.
Like?
They will spend money to have telemetry going to the hospital or their doctor. They will spend money to have their earphones controlled by the audiologist who prescribed them. They will spend money for value added.
Well, let me ask you, you have customized earphones or hearing aid. Is it expensive to upgrade or can it be upgraded?
It cannot be upgraded, and it is extremely expensive, and it is not covered by most insurance, certainly not by the government insurance programs. But, and it's a but, it's built to last. If I don't want the new technology, the hearing aids that I use, Hank, are the third generation, or they're three generations old. If the new generation that just came out is absolutely amazing in what it can do. And incidentally, I saw it at a trade show that you weren't able to make a couple of weeks ago. If I don't want those, my doctor said to me, the ones I'm using will probably satisfy me for the next 5 to 10 years. They're that well built.
Well, Joe, you know, we have in the last half hour of the show, we have three feature segments, and we're going to start it off with Dr. Alfred Poor, and let's get to it. Tonight, we have three feature segments. The first segment is from Dr. Alfred Poor on health and wearable issues. The second is a presentation by David Perry on what is VPN, what is it, and what is it not. And finally, we have Marty Winston to talk about what is home automation and what it's not. There's a lot of myth about it, and let's get some clarification. We hope that you've had a chance to listen to the special that we did on the convergence of technology with health issues that was on the air last week. If you're interested in last week's program, there is a podcast available on the archives. Let's go to Dr. Alfred Poor with health and wearable technology.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. As the old saying goes, horses sweat, gentlemen perspire, and ladies glow. Well, whatever your skin does when it gets hot, the fact is that that fluid that oozes through your pores contains a lot of different chemicals. We all know that sweat is salty, but it also carries other chemicals that are the byproducts of physiological processes in your body. These can be used as biomarkers. In other words, you can analyze the contents of sweat and determine a number of different factors. And in fact, many companies are now working on different devices that can sample the chemicals in your sweat to make different determinations about your health. Perhaps one of the most interesting, and for some people the most useful, is a product called Proof, which is being developed by a company called Mylo Sensors. And basically, it's a wristband that you wear. There's no other way to put it. Your wristband knows when you're drunk. It can actually measure the blood alcohol level based on your sweat. It uses replaceable cartridges. Each cartridge is good for about 12 hours. And while you're wearing it, the sweat is absorbed by the device. It analyzes it and puts out a signal that it sends by Bluetooth to a smartphone application that will tell you what your blood alcohol level is. You no longer have to wait till you're falling down to know whether or not you had one drink too many. Your wristband will be able to tell you. It's kind of a funny application, but at the same time, it's serious and can actually save lives and do some real good. The Proof is being developed, and it has been launched as an Indiegogo project. And in fact, the project sold out within 2 weeks of its launch. So it's clearly something that consumers are interested in. And the company behind it, Mylo Sensors, is also looking into other biomarkers that it may be able to detect in sweat and come up with other projects that could be useful in a band that you would wear on your wrist. One of the topics that I talk about a lot with wearable devices is the need for a good user interface. And there's no one single answer. But the fact is that if you've got something that you're wearing on your wrist or something, a small sensor that is strapped to your body someplace under your clothing, or perhaps something that's even implanted, well, the fact is that a keyboard or a touchscreen just isn't going to cut it. You don't have the real estate available for it, and it can be too cumbersome to try to manipulate it. It could be awkward at times. There are times when, you know, a keyboard or a touchscreen just really aren't going to be the solution. And so we see a lot of things using touch, solutions that turn parts of your body into touch pads, speech recognition so that you can give commands just by talking. Gestures, and you know, companies are looking at a bunch of different kinds of solutions. The researchers at the Fraunhofer Institute for Computer Graphics Research in Germany have come up with a very compelling and interesting idea for a user interface for wearable devices and other digital electronics. Basically, the concept is giving people a way to control devices without using their hands. This could be very convenient, and not only convenient, but also can be inconspicuous. So it could be a way for you to control your smartphone, for example, to decline a call without other people in the room noticing necessarily that you're actually done anything. If it's hands-free, it would also potentially be of benefit for people with disabilities who may not be able to control their limbs or are paralyzed and have no control over them at all. So what these researchers in Germany have come up with is they have a system that can detect the electrical currents that occur when you use different facial muscles. You use different muscles to smile or frown, to nod your head, to shake your head no. The fascinating thing about this project, though, is that the sensor for this system sits in your ear. It's like an earbud. You plug it into your ear canal. From that location, it can sense the muscle movements of your face. So smiling, winking, nodding, whatever, those can be signals to control devices subtly and hands-free. It could also be a way to monitor behaviors of the wearer. For example, if you're driving and you're sleepy and you start to nod off, this device could recognize that you're sleepy could recognize that you're nodding, you're not paying attention to the driving, and that could trigger an alert in a smartphone app or some electronics in the car to alert you to wake up and maybe to pull over and have a rest. Even beyond that, it could also perform hands-free control of mechanical devices. So, for example, somebody who's paralyzed might be able to use this interface to control a robotic arm or other devices to perform daily living tasks so that they could live independently. Right now, again, the researchers are focusing on the ear as the location for the sensor for this kind of a project. But the fact is that this same technology could be used in other parts of the body to detect muscle movements. We may end up finding that there are controllers that you'd strap to your leg or other parts of your body to do hands-free control of devices. One of the dreams about wearable technology, and in specific, the wearable health technology, is that these devices can gather data around the clock and make that data available to the individual, to their physicians, and to other people for analysis of health and wellness factors for the community at large. If we only knew enough about the lives and health of enough people, we could derive information that we'd need to know to predict and prevent many diseases and to improve the treatment of those diseases. This is what we call big data, and this is one of the key promises of the whole wearable health tech movement. The question becomes, where do we get all that data to analyze? Well, Google's parent company, Alphabet, has a project that one of their spinoffs, the company called Verily, they're running a big data health project called Project Baseline. That's trying to gather lots of health information about individuals. But now a new project has also been launched. The National Institutes of Health, NIH, has started its own data collection program. They call the campaign All of Us. And their goal is simply to enroll 1 million volunteer participants to share their health data. 1 million, which is amazing. And these people will be followed over a long period of time so that you can see cause and effect and you can get all this big data and run it through artificial intelligence to analyze, to find the connections, to find the correlations that could be interesting. The fact is that the program has already entered a beta testing phase, and they're in the process of signing up 10,000 initial participants all across the country. They've started with a single test site and are going to expand that to 100 sites nationally. By ramping up slowly like this, they're going to make sure that all their systems are in place and that the data collection is working the way it's supposed to, so that they can have everything working smoothly before they start signing up lots and lots of participants. The major rollout is by the end of 2017 or early 2018. So it's going to be starting very, very soon. The program is open to adults 18 and over in the U.S. And if you're interested in volunteering to become a part of this, just do a Google search for NIH and All of Us. And that'll take you to a link where you can find out more about the program and find out what you need to know in order to sign up to be one of the volunteer participants. Instead of donating blood, you can donate data. This data is going to help save lives and make the lives better for millions of people worldwide as we learn more about our bodies and health and illness and how to treat them effectively. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. With increasing concerns for security and privacy, VPN or virtual private networks are being used in communicating between one point to another. And we've asked David Perry to give an overview of VPN. What is it and what is it not?
This is David Perry for the Personal Computer Show. And I'm here to talk about virtual private networks or VPNs. Now, we all see a lot of information about VPNs being spread all over the internet. There's a lot of VPNs out there. Some are free, some cost money, and we'll discuss that. There are actually a variety of different major types of VPN, and we'll discuss that in a further episode. But today I just want to talk generally about VPNs, what they do for you, what they can't do for you, and why it's a pretty good tool to have in your arsenal against the rigors and dangers of the internet as we travel it, but that you might want to think of it as just another tool, and you have to keep those other tools well in place. A virtual private network is what we would refer to as an encryption tunnel. It encrypts the data going into your browser at your end of the deal, and it is unencrypted at the other end of an encryption tunnel that takes it to the place where the data is encrypted and unencrypts it there and can relaunch it onto the internet from any place in the world. Now, this has lots of different advantages. If I, for example, want to watch BBC television that isn't allowed to be seen by people logging on from inside the United States, and believe me, this is true, I can fire up a VPN and be in England. My computer appears to be in England and I can watch the BBC, and that's a great thing. Also, there are times when data transfer is better using a VPN than it would not be not using a VPN. Now, conversely, there are also times when using a VPN will not let you connect. There are lots of people that will not let you connect using a VPN, and they include major services like Netflix. So beware and take care, okay? So what does the VPN do for you? So it encrypts the data between your computer and the point of entry. It does not encrypt the data after the point of entry, so it remains vulnerable at that point. It does not encrypt the data on your computer, so it is vulnerable at that point, and that's the most important. It does not by itself, in and of itself, a VPN does not prevent you from being infected with malware, which as a consumer is your number one threat. Your number one threat remains malware to this very day. And malware, of course, does include viruses, trojans, worms, adware, spyware, blah, 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 blah. So the term malware was actually coined before any of the rest. It means malicious and unwanted software, and it goes to a man named Yisrael, who coined it at a conference way back in 1991. Okay, so here we are. We're in a world where we have malware, and the VPN by itself doesn't do anything to protect us from malware. Now, there are VPNs out there that do include malware protection, and I'm going to be talking about Opera VPN next week. And it does. And some of them use reputation services and other means to block you from the sources, the known sources of malware. And that's a very good thing, but it's not a function of a VPN. It's a function of their node where you re-enter the internet. Okay, so they're able to do that for you. This does not keep you from needing anti-malware on your system. It does not keep you from needing a firewall on your system. It does not keep you from needing strong passwords or a password manager. It does not keep you from any of the things, including, at its most basic, awareness of the dangers around you. But what it does guard you from is a man-in-the-middle attack. A man-in-the-middle attack would break into the communications chain between your computer and the internet, and at that point, read what was going on. Well, that isn't very cost effective for criminals. So instead, they send out malware like it was, you know, free things, like it was, you know, flyers for a local pizzeria. It just gives them to everybody that passes by on the street. And then the malware goes to your computer, gets in your computer, and gathers up if there's anything valuable or captures your computer for their means, and the VPN doesn't do anything to stop that because you get the malware from email and from drive-by downloads on the internet. The VPN does not stop those things. It doesn't do a thing to stop those things. Man-in-the-middle attack? Yes. So it will protect you if you're in your local Starbucks, and it will stop you from an evil twin attack happening there. It will stop you at the level of somebody at literally breaking into the side of your communications chain, which is not very common. So it is really protecting you in terms of a corner case. It has its uses, it has its advantages, and it has its disadvantages. There are some free things in the world that are ad-supported, and I have my opinions on that. There are some paid things. I use one of them myself, and I have my opinions on that. But what we really need to do is take a look at how we deal with all of our data.
Thank you, David. There is home automation, and there is home automation. Home automation should be something that is automatic, and you're able to change the environment automatically without you having to physically interact with the change itself. Today, A lot of what we call home automation is nothing more than you are required to interface with the device itself. Today, by interfacing with a smartphone to a device, they call that home automation. That is not home automation. What is lacking is standards of communication for unlike devices to properly talk to each other. And what is lacking is in the interface of things, there is no security standard. Marty Winston has some comments on this, and let's hear it.
If you've heard me here, or if you visited my 40yearhouse.com site, you know how I feel about the general topic that people are calling home automation and why I've moved on to creating what I think is aptly defined as a cybernetic house. But Hank just sent me an article that Herman Yao, who is the CEO of Tend, had placed in DealerScope magazine about selling smart home tech. I sent him a reply that I promised I would make an open letter. And so here it is. Herman, Hank Key at the Personal Computer Radio Show sent me a copy of your DealerScope article on selling smart home tech. I agree with enough of what you said, disagree with enough of what you said, and disagree with some of what your company is doing in the kind of mix that prompts me to make my reply to you an open reply. I'm recording it so Hank can run it on his show. By way of background, I've done several years of deep dives into the contemporary home automation category, both products and companies, and I am deeply disappointed that it has become little more than a novelty niche, more for devotees and fad followers than for any truly productive value. There's little out there that truly automates a home beyond the level of, for example, the old clockwork timers. Talking and listening interfaces are more entertainment than servant. To be fair, your article was about selling, which I presume you and your company are doing quite well, and not about delivering true value. For my own purposes, I am designing and will be building a cybernetic house. The basic difference is that today's home automation products increase chores and degrade privacy, both of which are, I believe, contrary to the true meaning and purpose of automation. One example of compromised privacy is your own company's Lynx indoor camera. I am a great believer in the value of surveillance cameras when outdoors, and forbid their use indoors. It's too easy for the Russian hackers to interpret what they see into opportunities for their comrades close to that location. But again, if the subject is selling things, concerns about sacrificing privacy are seldom part of that decision. I should add one more credential. I'm a former Radio Shack headquarters executive. I do understand retailing. You address the early adopter audience for connected home products, but significant parts of it were never allowed to form. Instant adopters and impassioned hobbyists were the pioneers in an umbrella categories, well, many umbrella categories, within which relationships remained tribal. Z-Wave versus Bluetooth versus Zigbee versus dozens of others with very little interoperability ever. So really, home automation is just an inherited descriptor that doesn't truly apply to most of the products claiming its umbra. Is Alexa automation or Siri or Cortana or Google Home? Really, they're just connected remote controls with limited speech recognition abilities. To a great extent, they're all toys, bought in part for entertainment value and in part because all the family and friends brag about theirs and leave others feeling like outcasts. So let me directly address your mantra on four things you think smart home products should manifest. First is, quote, products that are easy to use, quote. That's not a sales factor. Buyers don't know they're easy or hard to use until after they buy. But it is a misdirection. Smart home products should be invisible. They should melt into the rest of the house and only occasionally come to mind as how or why some good thing happened. You say simplicity. I say indispensability. Second, you cite a need for quality but give no context for what it means, and you do so within the context of pricing. retailers know that shoppers will buy what they want to buy, regardless of its quality or its pricing. What is it that creates that want? What is the why to buy? Way too many products are out there for the wrong reasons or for no reasons, and way too few can justify their cost in any reasonable way. Shoppers only need to know exactly how owning the product will make their lives better and why it's the right choice to do that. Third, you talk about security, but you're not offering anything that isn't getting hacked every hour of every day. A truly secure product will never connect to the cloud. So if you're serious about security, rethink any product that goes anywhere near the cloud and give it another better way to get its work done. Fourth, you name integration as if having more of something or things has some intrinsic value. That's unlikely without a major shift in architecture and has become a major underpinning of my own current design work. In one house with thousands of sensors providing 10 readings per second, more than 100 actuators and almost 100 controllers, plugging in one more sensor can take away more than it can ever add. And try to remember how very bad people tend to be about babysitting batteries. Sure, it would be nice if there were fewer Lego blocks in home control that just won't ever snap into their neighbors, but processing has to happen at the nodes as well as at the core. Integration. Different. You say, quote, getting smart home technology to bridge the chasm from early adopters to mass market consumers will require a joint effort between manufacturers and retailers, quote. That isn't how the world really works. When you create something that most people would rather not do without, they will find a way to buy it. And when enough of that happens, retailers will find a way to participate in selling it. You see, Herman, there is no such thing as capital S sales. That's a synthesis. What is a reality is purchasing, and that's a behavior. So it's more strongly driven by emotion than by logic. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. The Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting July the 25th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the community room of the Princeton Public Library in Princeton, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, July the 27th. Their presentation will be Troubleshooting Your Computer 101, and the meeting time is 7 p.m. Middletown Library, Large Community Room in Middletown, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on drones Thursday, August the 3rd, 7 p.m., they'll meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, room 101 in White Plains, New York. The Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, August the 8th. 7:15 p.m. is the meeting time, and they'll meet in the Rassel Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Mall in West Nyack. The New York Amateur Computer Club has its general meeting Thursday, August the 10th, meeting time is 7 p.m., at NYU Silver Building, room 411, located at 31 Washington Place, and that's in Manhattan, New York. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. Keep on computing and remember, backup, backup, and of course, backup. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe until we meet again, same time, same station next week.